Hi, good evening. It's January 16th, 5772, and this is Shiur number 11 of Derech Hashem, and we are in part one, chapter five, for the spiritual realm. Last week we started with the first paragraph, and we're going to do the first number, which is several paragraphs, and we're just going to review that quickly and then go on. But we can ask any questions on that also before we continue. So last week we began with just discussing that the world, the entire creation is divided into two realms, into physical and spiritual. The physical world, everything that's in it, is also divided into two realms, that which is celestial, everything in the sky and above, and that which is terrestrial, everything on earth, everything on earth, and then the spirit, including mankind. Then the spiritual realm includes everything that is non-physical, and that's also divided into two realms, souls and angelic creatures. Souls are everything that's supposed to go into a human body, anything that should be embodied, and the angelic creatures are further divided into angels and forces, or malachim and kochot, and they have different roles, which we'll discuss a little bit more today. So we discussed Shemot. Let me just see who joined, who just came on.
Hi, Suri Garfinkel.
Oh, hi, Suri. How are you?
I'm good. Okay. Thank you.
Good. We have somebody new on the call, so let's just break for 1 minute, and everybody just say what your name is, please, and what city you're calling from, and sort of what your one sentence about your role, just to reintroduce yourselves to each other so we'll know who's on the phone, if you don't mind.
So I'm Suri Garfinkel, and I live in Chicago, and we do college outreach on many campuses in Chicago.
I'm Ruchi Fryer. I live in Borough Park. That's in Brooklyn, New York, and I just met Lisa today at the AJOP convention. I'm a real estate attorney by profession, but I love Kirov, and I do lots of work with kids at risk, primarily boys, from the Kidstrip community here in Brooklyn.
I'm Hannah Rudnick, and I live in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where I work part-time at the Tennessee Aquarium, but I also teach a class in women's prayer in Atlanta, Georgia.
Bonnie Pincus, I live in Montreal, and I am and partner with my husband in NCSY Montreal.
Great, and then we have a lot of people who listen by recording. I know in Portland, Oregon, and also in Montreal, and around the country, a few different people listen by recording, and I don't even know. I just, so you know, for full disclosure, just so everybody should know, I get an email every time somebody listens by recording. So I don't always associate the number with the name because it just tells me which phone number called in and how long they listened. So I do know that people are calling in. So I know when somebody makes the phone call to the recording. And then people also listen online on my website. So, and I don't know who does that. But I do get emails occasionally from people who are listening in. So I really appreciate the feedback, just anybody who's listening by recording. It's so nice to get emails and get a question or a comment or even just that you appreciate it. It's really nice because it's great having the people who call in live. And it's for me, it's a real chizik knowing that there's other people listening too. And I appreciate having the questions or the comments. It's nice to hear. So, okay, so that's the four who are here tonight. And just so you can hear that it's really across the country, across the countries, because we have Canada too. Okay, so back to this. Okay, so we're with souls. So souls are that which goes into a human body, and kohot, the forces, there's angels and forces, and that's what the universe began with. I mean, it began with Hashem, of course, and then he created kohot, and the kohot then into malachim, and then we have souls that become embodied, and then we'll just leave a blank space right there for a second, and then the physical world, and then humans, and then he put souls into human beings. Human beings are the only creature in the entire Bria that consists of physical and spiritual mixed together. Now, where I said leave a blank space is where we talked about last week, the category of creation called Shadim. And Shadim are not physical and not spiritual, but somewhere possibly in between. I did ask, Suri asked last week, if there's a positive counterpoint to Shadim in the creation. So I did ask two different rabbis about it. So first of all, let's talk about Shadim all together for just a minute and the continuum of creation that we just discussed. So So according to the Rambam, Shadim don't exist at all. And we know that the Ramban, we know that the Ramchal is basically going with the Kabbalah that's closer to the Ramban, and he goes with the Kabbalah of the Ari. So there is a machloka between the Rambam and the Ramban and their shitas and these things, which we discussed in terms of Olam Haba and Olam HaNeshamot and how that works out. But in this particular case also, so the Rambam holds there's no such thing as Shadim. However, we have quite a bit of material that discuss Shadim and what they do, and they're not always negative. So one rabbi told me, Rabbi Tzvi Steinberg, who's our new Rav in Denver. We've been Ravless for a year and a half, and we have a new Rav now. So he told me that Shadim are a mix, an inappropriate mix of Tuma and Kedusha. And that the head shade's name, and just for the purposes of this class, I'll pronounce it, but, you know, I don't think we usually pronounce it. I'll just spell it. It's spelled Samech Mem Aleph Lamed. So the word Sam means a drug, often a negative kind of a drug, Sam Hamavet. There can also be, I think, I'm not sure where it's placed possibly in poetic literatures. It's also used sometimes positive for like a love sickness, but it's often seen as when we say drugs in a negative way, like street drugs, that's sam or samim. In modern Hebrew, samim is street drugs, as opposed to, let's say, trufot, healthy drugs. And then, of course, Aleph Lamed is Hashem's name. So you have that blend of elixir, negativeness, and Hashem in the name of the top shade, whatever that means, that there could be somebody in charge of all of them, it's a question. So, but at least as a concept, sometimes when we have a name of something, it's not even always that it's absolutely 100% true. Like, for instance, Midrashim. Just because a midrash has a story doesn't mean that that story happened that way. It means that what it's teaching is something that's true. So for sure, if the name, quote-unquote, of the head, quote-unquote, shade is spelled that way, it means that there is a mixture of the positive and the negative together. So so that was Rabbi Steinberg. Rabbi Yoel Unger said that really what the Ramchal is presenting here is a theory. While it is Kabbalah and it is received information, nobody knows for sure all the different categories, and he's presenting a theory of the categories that exist, and that the category of Shadim is up for question. It's possible that they do, and it's possible that they don't, but that he presented it as a continuum from the physical, so let's go from the inanimate, right, from rocks and water and inanimate objects. So you have, as we know, we have inanimate to plants, to animate, to humans, to Yisrael, that's the level. So we have Domeim, Tzomeach, Chai, Medaber, Yisrael are the levels of the Bria, and then so they go up like that. And then if you're using that in ascending order in terms of going from physical to spiritual within Medaber and Yisrael, you have that blend of physical and spiritual, but then you want to go into the strictly spiritual world. So it seems like there might be a bridge in between the physical and the spiritual, other than human beings, which are a kosher mix of the two, where there's sort of a nebulous mix of physical and spiritual that's really neither but affects both, sort of, and that would be the role, the space where Shadim might occupy in the construct of the flow from physical to spiritual. So does there need to be a positive counterbalance for them? It seems like not. If they do exist, which we have plenty of rabbinic literature saying that they do, they don't do only negative things. So you wouldn't need a positive counterforce, according to Rabbi Yoel Unger, and according to Rabbi Steinberg, a positive counterforce could be malachim, who do positive things. But either which way, of course, all of them are under the dominion of Hashem. So all of them still only do what Hashem wants, and they don't have free will. They still function in the world in a way to create the environment in which human beings can function. Let me stop there for a second. Pardon?
It's Rookie. Can I make a comment?
Yes, you can.
It's funny because very often there are certain minhagim that we have, and that the reason why we do it is because of Shadim. For example, when people do renovations in their house, and they take a doorway, and they want to close it up, and they make a wall out of it. You can't completely close it up. You have to leave a small little opening, like even as wide as a little pipe, because otherwise the shaving won't have where to go out of. And it sounds silly, and it sounds like amateurish when you think about it, but we're very strict about it.
Right, we are. Right, so I think the Rambam would possibly hold that that's not okay, but I'm not sure. Now, it's fascinating. I don't know if you were in Rabbi Becher's class today. Were you?
Which one? I was in the history one.
The history one where he showed the things from the Cairo Geniza.
Yeah.
So it was fascinating to see the Rambam's writing right next to the halach of the Rambam, right next to a photograph of a mezuzah from the Cairo Geniza. So it was a regular mezuzah, a regular cloth with the regular things written on it, except for, in addition to the regular stuff written on it, it had a column of the names of different malachim, maybe 10 different angelic names, and across the bottom it had some Shemot Hashem plus some Magen Davids. So apparently it's not just a mezuzah, it was transformed into a talisman. Which is usher, and the Rambam specifically described that very construct, writing at the time that such a mezuzah would be written, and then, of course, the writings of the Rambam and that mezuzah were found in the same place in the Cairo Geniza, but he said specifically you're not allowed to write names of angels or angelic names or additional names of Hashem or any other kind of thing on a mezuzah. It takes something kadosh and makes it treif. So we do have plenty mixing in Yiddishkeit, in Jewish ideas, and so so it's a question. You know, we definitely have an admixture from different places where we've traveled and different societies that we've been part of, things that we've taken on and taken in. But we are, in general, pretty careful about closing up and opening, that's for sure. In general, I think people are careful. So I think the halacha today is that we're careful with that. And I don't actually know if that's halacha, but in the broader sense that we've discussed halacha before as the way that we walk as Jews, certainly in practice we are careful about not completely closing up openings because of that. It doesn't seem to be a something that's poo-pooed by the masses. It is something that we're careful about. So we do respond to, as if there is a reality of Shadim, and we certainly, again, have plenty in the Gemara that discusses them, and the Rambam still holds they don't exist. The Ban holds they do. But we'll leave it there anyway, that there's not a lot of discussion here about Shadim. He leaves us off with basically this one paragraph that's part of section one in chapter five, with this one paragraph just explaining that they do exist and that they have many different types, and those different types can function in different ways. And the types are so different among the category of Shadim that the different types can be considered separate species belonging to a general class of Shadim. So I'm just trying to think where I reread today, but I did, it was probably last night when I was looking at Torah.org, where Rabbi Yaakov Feldman has his commentary on Derech Hashem. And he just reminds us also that Shadim, there are so many Shadim that, and so many Malachim also, that if we could see them, we wouldn't be able to function. They're all over the place. So again, I think it is similar to bacteria and to the tiny little bugs that we don't see. I hate to say that in the New York area where they actually have a bug plague right now. It makes me nervous, but they're even smaller than that. All the little bugs that are all over our body and all over everything. If we could see it, we'd freak out about how many bugs there are. So Baruch Hashem, we can't. But the same thing with the amount of Shadim and Malachim all over, we would feel so crowded if we could see how many there are everywhere. And yet they are there. And we can function with them. So we know that they're there, but we don't have to necessarily interact, but we are careful. And we discussed last time also about physical procedures to protect ourselves spiritually, and how one might do that. But the main protection, we talked last time a little bit about tznius, but the main protection from negative forces and attachment of negative forces to one is careful adherence to Torah and mitzvahs. When one uses the physical world, which is what mitzvot are, using the physical world to create a spiritual effect, then one is engaging in the physical properly, and then the negative things can't affect as much as if somebody's not careful. So we don't have to turn to segulas, just to straight up Torah and mitzvahs. That's the way to put ourselves into a place of right balance so that we can't really be affected negatively. So let me, or as much negatively, depends on how right a balance we put ourselves in. Let me just stop there for questions before I continue. No questions? Okay, I want to bring you a Tomer Devorah that just discusses this a little bit, because as long as we're on this topic, I think it's pretty fascinating. So the book Tomer Devorah is written by Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak, who was one of the Kabbalists in Tzfat. And it's one of a series of books he wrote, different tamarim, different palm trees, and the imagery being an oasis in the desert. So this is one of them. Tomer Devorah discusses the Yud Gimel Midos HaRachamim, the 13 attributes of mercy of Hashem, so his qualities, Hashem's qualities. And so the book is a Kabbalistic sefer, but it goes through those 13 qualities. And if they are the qualities of Hashem and we're created in Hashem's image, then it must be that they're also our qualities. And the more we could get to know Hashem, the more we could know ourselves. And the more we get to know ourselves, the more we could know Hashem. And if we can get to learn these qualities, we know what to aspire to and how to behave like Hashem. That's the premise of the book, or at least the first half of the book, where it goes through all 13 qualities. So here's quality number 2 in the Tomer Devorah, and it has to do with this. It's pretty fascinating and a little bit scary, but it's interesting to hear. So, and it kind of fits in with this, so we'll discuss it. So I'm going to read in English, even though the Hebrew here is much easier, but I want the main idea here. Okay, so quality number 2, Nosei Avon. It's called Nosei Avon. This attribute is greater than the previous one, for when a person transgresses, a destructive creature is created. I'll just read that so you hear that in the Hebrew. Let's see. Sherei lo ya'aseh ha'adam avon shelo yivra mashchit. So when a person does an avon, he creates a mashchit, a destructive creature. As stated in the Mishnah, he who commits a single transgression acquires against himself a single accuser. Right? Ha'over avira achat konelo kategor echad. So we actually create a creature. So we know this. Our children are taught this, and we've learned this also. When we do a mitzvah, we create a malach. So it could sound cute, but it's actually true. When we do something, when we engage in the physical world, we create a corresponding spiritual force. So let me just continue with this, and then we'll go into a little bit deeper. Considering that no being in the world exists except by virtue of the fact that the Holy One, blessed be He, grants it life, how does this force of destruction stand before Him? The strict letter of the law would justify that the Holy One, blessed be He, should claim, I do not nourish destructive creatures. Go to Him who made you and derive your sustenance from Him. Then the destructive creature would immediately descend and take the life of the sinner, or cut him off from his spiritual source, or punish him according to his just deserts, until the destructive being would cease to be. Nevertheless, the Holy One, blessed be He, does not make this claim. Rather, He bears the sin and endures it. And just as He sustains the entire world, He sustains this destructive creature until one of three things happens. One, the sinner repents, destroying or nullifying the destructive creature by his act of penance. Or two, the righteous judge nullifies it through the suffering or the death of the sinner. Or three, the sinner descends to Gehenna to pay his debt. Okay, so let's just go back here. So when we do a negative act, when we do an avera, we create a destructive force. That destructive force is created by us. Part of the image of Hashem that we're created in is that Hashem is the creator and can create things. And He empowered us also in a small parallel way to be able to create. So when we do something negative, we do create. When we do something positive too, but right now we'll talk about the negative. When we do something negative, we create a negative creature. It's an actual creature that exists. All creatures need sustenance. So since we are the creator of this negative creature, really that negative creature has every right to turn to us to demand its sustenance. But the sustenance that it needs is not food. We can't give it something out of our refrigerator. What it needs is life energy. And we only have our own life energy. So it is permitted to demand from us our life energy to sustain it because we created it. So we owe it our life. That's what the Tomer Devorah is saying. However, so that would be straight din. That's straight justice. However, Hashem puts a hold on it by divine decree. And his characteristic of nosei avon, nosei means carry or lift up. Like nisuin, marriage, you're carrying each other, but you're lifting up also into a different realm. So nosei avon, one of Hashem's character traits is that he actually carries the avera itself. He carries the creature that was created through the avera that we did so that we don't have to carry it. So that we have the space to do tshuva. He waits for us, and he sustains that negative creature so that it can't come get us, basically, until we have a chance to do tshuva and or suffer and or die, so that that creature can be nullified. So the three options that will nullify that creature is one, tshuva, two, suffering and or death, three, Gehenim. So those are our three options. Tshuva, of course, being the one that we're totally in charge of. So we can get rid of those negative creatures, totally destroy them and nullify them through tshuva. And if we don't, then Hashem will help us along with Yisurin or with Gehenim. So that's up to us, how we want to get rid of it. But Hashem, in his mercy, because these are 13 attributes of mercy, so Hashem's rachamim will help us not have to face the entire negativity of the creation of the creature that we create of. Yeah, the negativity of the creature that we created, he allows us to get rid of it in those three ways. So, so that's on the negative. On the positive, when we do a mitzvah, we create a positive energetic force. So I don't know which of you, how you learned it in school when you were young, but I know that my children learned it pretty graphically. There was a real picture, so that they learned that a malach is created whenever they make a bracha, whenever they do a mitzvah. But, for instance, if they would make a bracha without kavana or without a lot of kavana, so they would still make an angel, but they would make a crippled angel. Right? So they'd have an angel on crutches. They'd have some healthy angels, some angels on crutches, some angels missing limbs because they weren't fully created, because there wasn't total kavana in doing it, or whatever it is. So that I know my children's teachers painted for them a picture of malachim that would be created through the positive things that they did. They never talked about the negative, fortunately. I don't think that would be good for kids to hear. But the malachim that they created, but they would sometimes create malachim with missing parts that weren't whole because a mitzvah might not be done in a whole way. So while that's a graphic way to explain it, and we do try to explain things to children in ways that they can understand, of course we don't ever have angels on crutches, but it's just an idea to say that the quality of the act that we do creates a corresponding quality of spiritual creature. So I think if we phrase it that way, whether it's positive or negative, whether the quality is a strong quality or a weak quality, anywhere on the spectrum, whether we do something with kavana or without kavana, whether that thing is positive or negative, the quality of the physical act that we do creates a corresponding quality of spiritual entity. So it could be a positive or a negative spiritual force in the world that's created through what we do. Why is that the case? So let me just stop and see if there's any questions, because this is a little bit complicated, and then I'll continue, and hopefully we'll be able to see why that's the case. Any questions so far? You're still there, right?
Yeah, we're still here.
Just making sure. Okay, good. Okay.
One of us is.
Okay, good. Just making sure. Okay. All right, so I'm going to go on to paragraph 2. We are well aware of physical things and their natural properties, and their laws are well known. Spiritual concepts, on the other hand, are outside of our realm of experience and therefore cannot be adequately described. When we speak of spiritual entities and phenomena, we must therefore rely completely on the traditions handed down to us. Okay, so this is not science. We can understand the physical world through science, through observation and engagement with the physical phenomena, but the spiritual phenomena we can't really test through scientific methods, which I think parenthetically is important to explain to those people who are trying to attack religion through science and just say they're measured. It's not that they deal with different realms. They're measured differently. You can't measure one by the other. You can't measure spiritual with physical tools. One of these fundamentals is that everything in the physical world has a counterpart among the transcendental forces. Every entity and process in the physical world is linked to these kohot, following a system decreed by God's wisdom. These kohot are therefore the roots of all physical things, and everything in the physical world is a branch and a result of these forces. The physical and the spiritual are thus bound together like links in a chain. We also know from tradition that every physical entity and process is under the charge of some type of malach. These malachim have the responsibility of maintaining the natural order, as well as bringing about changes according to God's decree. Okay, so let's go back for that for just a minute. So we know that the world is created through koach hadibur. Hashem spoke and things came into existence. And that's one reason why in Lashon HaKodesh, the word devar means both word and thing, because first it was spoken and then it came into existence. So devar is the same, right? A word and a thing is the same thing. It just exists on two different realms. And we have the concept that kiva katz or olamim, with the name yud and hey, Hashem created the worlds. So we understand that the upper worlds are created with the letter yud. And the lower world, this world that we live in, was created with the letter He. So what are those two letters? Let's just look at them for a minute. So the letter Yud looks like the seed of life. It looks like what a man can offer to a woman in terms of producing a baby, but all the DNA is contained in that. Yud is the tiniest letter, and it's the tiniest unit, but there's so much inherent in that. So the upper worlds are created like that, like the seed of life, where nothing has been brought to fruition yet, and although the entire genetic code is inside that tiny little cell. So the upper worlds are like that, created with the devar, the word of Hashem, but all in potential yet, not in manifestation yet. And the lower world, the world that we live in, is created with the letter He. The letter He is pronounced just, it's just breath. It's just an exhalation. Without a vowel, it's just a... But it is the manifestation. It's the bringing out of the inner essence. If we have a neshama inside, it's a neshima to the outside. That's what hey is. It's the transfer of the inside to the outside. It's bringing something into fruition. So the upper world, the spiritual worlds, are created with the letter yud, and that's considered a masculine energy, the energy of potential. And the lower worlds are connected, but they're created with the letter hey. Hey is shaped like the birth canal, right? It has an opening in the bottom, and things can exit from that. So it's shaped like, it's considered a feminine letter in that sense, and it is the a letter of manifestation. So the connection then between the upper worlds and the lower worlds is like links in a chain, that it's sort of one manifests the other. So think about a person in the sun and a shadow of that person, right? So the shadow and the person are directly connected. Without the sun shining on the person, there wouldn't be the shadow on the sidewalk. So, but this world, but the shadow is light as opposed to the person. I mean, it's dark, but I mean, it's lightweight as opposed to the person, which seems like a very heavy, thick thing compared to the shadow, which seems so thin and light. But the shadow follows the behavior of the person. So just flip that image in thinking about the upper world and the lower world. Really, this world that we live in is the shadow world, except for it's heavy. But it directly follows, just like a shadow does, it directly follows the person like a shadow does. So this world is the heavy, thick shadow of the upper worlds, which are the thinner light. But they move first and we move second. We are the shadow world in that sense. That's a mashal, but does that make sense so far, what I'm saying?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
You understand that concept? Okay, good. So the upper worlds then, the spiritual worlds are, that's the initiator of everything, and the physical world then is the recipient of the initiation of the energies, and that's where it's made manifest. So, and the malachim are that agent which make it manifest. So for anybody who knows a little biology, and I can't say I know a lot, but I do know this word, which helps a lot in understanding malachim and how they function. They are spiritual neurotransmitters. So a neurotransmitter is that agent in the body, that bit of either electricity or hormone or whatever it is that transmits the information, but a neurotransmitter transmits information from our thoughts to our neurons. So if we have an itch on our cheek, then however that itch gets started, somehow something is felt on our cheek, and the neurotransmitter brings the sensation of the itch to our brain and says, alert, there's an itch on your cheek. And then your brain says, okay, that should be scratched. I'm going to send a message down the arm to the finger to move up and scratch that itch. So, but it goes as fast as a flash, of course, the whole process. Neurotransmitters go very quickly, but without a neurotransmitter, the message can't go from the brain to the hand to scratch the itch. And it can't go from the cheek to the brain either to say there is an itch. It's the neurotransmitter that brings the information back and forth. So a malach is a spiritual neurotransmitter, in a sense. So what a malach does is bring the thought, so to speak, of Hashem into fruition. So Hashem has set up the world. It's an olam. Olam comes from the word he'elem, hidden. Right? This world is hidden. It's our job as human beings to find Hashem in it, but he set it up in a way that he's hidden. So part of the way he did that is by creating different energy transfer stations through which energy, which Hashem's energy is made manifest, so that there's a distance between Hashem and the manifestation of Hashem's energy, so that it's not so easy to see cause and effect. That's one reason why there's distance altogether between cause and effect, because the world is set up with distance between the two, so that we wouldn't be able to immediately see. By observing effect, we wouldn't immediately see cause with a capital C, that Hashem is in charge of everything and runs everything. They would have to look a little bit between at the connection between cause and effect. So as a concept, cause and effect are distance. That's why we can eat chocolate cake and not get fat that minute. There's a distance between cause and effect. Even often in speaking Lashon Hara or things like that, certainly in physical efforts, but sometimes in spiritual efforts too, there's a distance between cause and effect. You don't immediately hurt the person when you speak Lashon Hara, but it ripples out and it causes deeper and deeper harm spiritually and physically to the person that you speak about, to yourself. There's a distance between the two of cause and effect, which is what permits us to do averas, even as ma'aminim, even as believers, because we don't see the immediate effect of the negative things that we do. That creates space for free will. Anyway, so one of the reasons that space needs to exist for free will to exist, and one of the mechanisms of that space are the kochot and the malachim that create a distance between Hashem and Hashem's ratzon, and that ratzon becoming manifest. So, but we have this concept, the last sentence, I'll just reread. These angels have the responsibility of maintaining the natural order as well as bringing about changes according to God's decree. Okay, so I didn't find it in the Sefer HaChinuch, but I've seen it before. I wanted to read it to you directly. But in the Sefer HaChinuch, in the mitzvah of not mixing species of trees, he explains that the reason for that, because he does give the Shoreshei HaMitzvot, why, what's the purpose of the mitzvah. So it's a fascinating chinuch. He says that the reason for that we're not permitted to mix species of trees, we are permitted to eat a mixed fruit that came from the tree, so we're allowed to eat nectarines, but we're not allowed to make a nectarine. And the reason is because there's a malach in charge of each species of tree, each species of everything. But in this case, we're talking about trees. So there's a malach in charge of each species of tree. And if we'll take a branch off of one tree and graft it onto another species of a different tree and create a new type of tree, a new type of fruit will come from that, the question is, which malach will be in charge of that? It sends... Pardon?
No, I have a question, but I'll ask it later.
Okay, I'll just finish the sentence quickly. So it sends, in a way, a spiritual, an electric shock charge, sort of back up the back up into the system, and shocks the malachim, so to speak. So they're not sure who's in charge of that tree. It's hard on them. Eventually, the new tree is created, the new malach is assigned, but we're not, we human beings are not permitted to engage in mixing species, partially for the reason that it does interrupt the angelic force flow of forces from above below. We're not allowed to mix into that area.
But we can eat the product of a non-Jew does it?
Mm-hmm. We can even eat it, I think, if a Jew does it. We're not allowed to mix it. That's mm-hmm. where the harm comes from, mixing it. But once it's been mixed, then the energy is rearranged and a new malach is assigned, and then there is a malach in charge of that tree and that fruit. But we're not allowed to cause the mixture, but we are allowed to eat the mixture.
It's interesting because it brings to mind the question of, we're not allowed to cut down a fruit-bearing tree. We can cut down any other tree, but a fruit-bearing tree is something that we cannot cut down. And people are really, really very strict with that. So there must
very
be some,
strict, yeah.
There
yeah.
must be some concept, and I never understood why, but it may be something to do with the fact that there are different kinds of malachim on fruit-bearing trees and on, you know, evergreen trees, you know?
Mm-hmm. You might be right. It's interesting because I know that is halacha. That's not minhag for sure. It's halacha.
Mm-hmm.
And even in a case where, I mean, I knew two different families, one who had poison ivy growing all over an apple tree, and they were having such a hard time getting rid of the poison ivy. They wanted to cut down the tree and, like, just burn out the hole to really kill the poison ivy that was there and was they were having a hard time getting rid of. And they couldn't get a heter to do it. They had to figure out a different way to get rid of the poison ivy, but they weren't allowed to sacrifice the fruit tree to get rid of poison ivy, which is dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I know another family also that has a crab apple tree. It's not even, I mean, it's an edible fruit, but it's not one that you want. It's mostly one that made a huge mess out of their yard and lots of bees
mm-hmm.
came all over. And if they would keep it all picked up, it wouldn't be a problem, but just they didn't want that tree or that fruit was making a mess, and they also weren't permitted to cut it down. So it is
mm-hmm.
halacha. It's a very strong thing not to cut down a fruit tree. I think part of it is hakaras hatov to
mm-hmm.
trees and what they give us. But you're right. It's an interesting question if there's anything about the malachim in trees and that we might not be permitted there. That's an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. I have another question, and maybe you covered it in the earlier classes. When we talk about the upper world and the lower world, but after a person dies and we say, okay, the person, the neshama goes up to Shemayim, which part are we talking about? Is there a different level than
yeah,
the
there's different levels. I'll first let you listen to some of the other classes, and then I'll be happy to answer that. Because, yeah,
already?
we did discuss that. Yeah, because I was in the, I think in the second chapter. So just flip back in your Derech Hashem if you don't want to listen to all the classes at once. I did label on my website. All the classes are labeled exactly. I'll try it. When I get home, I'll send you all the like descriptions. But you can look on my website, and it has a short paragraph of each class, and it also has of what's in each class, but it also has the exact paragraphs that we covered in each class. So
okay.
You can find that paragraph of Olam Haba in the text, and then you can listen to that class. But then after that, I'll be happy to answer, or off the call, I'll answer too. Okay, so let's see. Do I want to bring anything more? Really, also the flow of the class is 45 minutes of shiur and then 15 minutes of questions on anything. So you can certainly ask questions during the class, but then there's questions that can be asked about afterwards, or questions on anything, any kiruv thing or any question on anything Jewish that comes up in the week, anything that you're dealing with, you can ask questions about anything related to the text or not related to the text after the first 45 minutes, which I think we're at. So let me just leave the question, though, so that we're clear on the question that we're going to start with next week, which is, let's see where I asked that question. So why is it that we're the only ones that can send energy back up the spectrum? I don't know if that's what I asked before, but we want to look at the interplay of how the energy flows down. So with the spiritual neurotransmitters, basically with malachim, energy comes from Hashem and is manifest coming down everything experiences the energy from up to down. And human beings are the only ones that can send energy back up. So we'll see that as we go a little bit further forward. But basically we have this concept that everything starts as a koach. That's Hashem's first, first there's Hashem, then there's Hashem's thought, so to speak. So just like when we think a thought, I mean, it's not just like, this is a mashal, but it's similar to. We think a thought, but we haven't expressed it yet. So there's a thought in our head that's a clear thought, not just that first flash of thought that's not yet formed, but a formed thought is distinct from us, even though it hasn't been, so to speak, sent out of us, right? We haven't spoken it out or written it down, but it still isn't us anymore. It's separate and distinct, but still in us. Then we might speak it, write it, somehow manifest the thought just as an idea. Then it comes out of us. So really there's Hashem, and then there's the world of Atzilut. So that would be right, Atzilut being next to Etzel. So that would be when the thought is next to, and that's where the world of Kohot begins, is right after that, where they can receive that thought and then bring it down the different levels, which we'll get into later, where the thought becomes manifest. Everything experiences the energy flowing down from Hashem, so to speak, onto it, except for human beings who experience that. Plus, we have the ability to enter into that system and send energy back up. So we'll talk about that. I think we'll get to that in paragraph 4. But let's break here for a question. So you can ask that question again if you want. But first, let's see if there's other questions.
Okay. All right, so I'll wait for someone else.
Okay. Any other questions?
No?
Okay, so you can ask that question if you want to go into that. So do you want to re-ask?
So when we talk about the celestial world and the terrestrial world, right? So we have the difference, the world up above and the world here down below. Now, I always wanted to know, after a person dies, that we say the neshama goes up to Shemayim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, are there seven levels of heaven, and the neshamas go in one level, or is it all just one big heaven up above?
Okay, so Olam Haba, there's a few different ways to answer the question. So I'm going to start with this. There is no heaven. Let's start with that. Okay, there's not one. So we do say up to Shemayim. That's just words and doesn't really mean anything. So there is no up to Shemayim. The celestial world is part of the physical world, and that's not where the souls go. Right? The celestial world is all the stars and galaxies and everything that's out on all the planets. That's everything that's outside of our atmosphere, but it's still all physical. So that's not the Olam HaNishamot. The Ramchal discusses an Olam HaNishamot, which is a holding zone of souls until Olam Haba. But let's just back up for 1 second and discuss Olam Haba. So Olam Haba is an experience, not a place, right? The difference between the physical and the spiritual is that the physical world can be measured in terms of space, and the spiritual world cannot. So there's nothing about space in spiritual. So you can't say you're going to that place, right?
Exactly.
And yet we do use that language.
Is that like Einstein's theory of relativity? Time, space, and matter? Is that something?
I don't think so, because that's about physical. I'm not sure 100%, but that's about the physical. So, and this is about the spiritual. So let's just first hear this concept that Olam Haba is an experience, not a place. Okay, so I have a Club Med analogy that I use, or a cruise ship analogy. That works well for Olam Haba. So let's just imagine a cruise, right? So you go onto a boat. The thing about a cruise is that it pulls away from the shore, and it's a closed experience, right? Whatever's on the boat is on the boat for that week or that 2 weeks. So let's just imagine a two-week cruise. You and your husband get on this boat. It's completely kosher. Everything there is 100% kosher, except on this cruise, nobody else is on it except for the staff that's there to run the boat and take care of your every need, right? So, but there are no other guests and not your children. Your children are completely taken care of. It's just you and your husband for 2 weeks alone on this boat. So if you have a good marriage, it's fabulous. You know, you have 2 weeks alone with no distractions. There's no grocery shopping. There's no work. There's no internet connection. Your cell phone doesn't work. It's you and your husband completely alone with every need taken care of, no worries and concerns at all, just the two of you alone for 2 weeks. So if you have a good marriage, you are in heaven. But if you have a bad marriage, you're in hell because it's 2 weeks alone with your spouse with no distractions. There's no grocery shopping. There's no meals to prepare. There's no kids to take care of, no carpool, no internet, no telephone, no nothing except for you and your husband completely alone for 2 weeks with no distractions. So that the quality of the experience is directly related to the quality of the relationship. So Olam Haba is you and Hashem alone. And the quality of your experience is directly related to the quality of your relationship. This is the world in which you create the relationship, and that is the world in which you live in the relationship. So it's not a place, even though we tell all kinds of jokes, you know, that talk about it being a place. Do you know what a Hadassah lady is?
Do I know her?
Do you know what a Hadassah lady is, what Hadassah is and the Hadassah ladies?
Is that the hospital?
A Hadassah is a hospital. I mean, for this joke, you just have to know what a Hadassah lady is, right? Hadassah is a hospital that's been funded by the Hadassah ladies. It's a 100-year-old organization that really got together to fund health care in Israel, and they created this hospital. But a Hadassah lady is your classic Long Island, not religious, but very Jewish lady. Right, a good fundraiser, because look how much money they raised for the last 100 years. That's what a Hadassah lady is, right? So for this joke, okay, so we tell the joke of there's a busload of Hadassah ladies, 30 Hadassah ladies, and they're cruising along on a tour bus in Israel, and the bus goes off the road, and they all die. Up they go to the pearly gates, and they knock on the gates, and they say, "Hello, we're the Hadassah ladies, let us in." And the Malach comes and says, "The Hadassah ladies, I don't have you on my list." And they say, "What do you mean? We're the ladies from Hadassah. Of course we're on the list. Let us in." And he says, "I don't see you. I think you're going to have to go downstairs." And they can't believe it. They look at each other, but downstairs they go. 5 minutes later, the Malach at the front gate gets a buzz from Hashem. Says, "No, the Hadassah ladies get there yet?" And the Malach says, "What do you mean, the Hadassah ladies?" He says, "I'm excited."
Hello?
Yeah? What happened?
I don't know what happened. Things just sort of dropped off. This is Hannah Rudnick. Who else is here yet still?
It's me, Ruchi.
Oh, so I guess we got dropped, huh?
We got dropped or she got dropped?
Well, I don't know. Something got dropped. We're here. Maybe they're at their space or something. I don't know.
Sometimes
by accident.
Hello?
Yeah. I'll probably call back.
What?
Sometimes who's there?
It happens. Sonny Pincus from Montreal. It's happened before where the call gets dropped and then she'll try to call in again unless it doesn't work.
Okay.
And then she'll email.
But we just hang on here. We should just hang on together and, you know, just wait for it to come back?
Wait a couple of minutes. If she doesn't come back, we'll hang up, and then she'll probably email us all saying, "Sorry, something happened."
Yeah.
So who's on the line? Let's see if I remember who's on the line with us. Someone from Ontario?
This is Donna Rudnick.
And you're from where?
Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Oh, wow. I was never there. All right.
Not many
and
people have been.
And Sonny Pincus, Montreal.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Chattanooga, Tennessee. Wow. That sounds very interesting. Have you ever been here on the East Coast?
I'm sorry, what?
Have you ever been to New York?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was born in Rochester, New York.
Oh, okay. And what brought you to Chattanooga?
My husband was an optometrist. We weren't from at the time, and Chattanooga seemed to be a really nice place. We're not big city people.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
But the community has since died out from under us, pretty much, and we go down to Atlanta, Georgia, for sure.
Mm-hmm. How far is the drive to Atlanta?
It's about an hour and a half. But since my husband's in private practice, he, you know, can make his own hours. So we go down Thursday night, and that gives us a chance to, my husband gets to go to Minion. He has some Harusas down there. We go to Lunch and Learn. So it works out nicely.
Oh, that's very nice. Very nice. And how long are you ladies all learning together?
Sorry, what?
How long are you doing this lecture together?
Oh, we've been doing this about 15 years.
15
no,
years?
This is Derech Hashem Shir, I think you mean. With Elisa?
Oh, Derech Hashem.
She just started
just
in
when
November.
She started in November. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I just met her today, and I said, I saw she was holding the Derech Hashem book, and I said, oh, wow, I read that book two times, and I still don't get it. So I gave a shear on the phone there, really, and I said, I'm signing up.
Yeah.
That was so amazing. I'm so glad that I at least I came in at, you know, at the fifth lesson and not at the end.
Yeah.
It's really amazing stuff. It really is. Oh, well, I wonder if she's going to call back.
Yeah, it seems like she's not going back. Is AJAP over already?
What?
Is AJAP over? Did it finish today?
It's still going on tomorrow, but I didn't stay. I wasn't going to stay for the third day.
Uh-huh.
And,
were you there for Shabbos or just there Sunday, Monday?
No, I don't even think it was open to the public for Shabbos. I was just there on Sunday and Monday. Now I'm back home.
Now, where was it being held?
It was in Stamford, Connecticut.
Stamford, Connecticut. Okay.
Stamford, yeah.
That's
the
kosher kitchen that they
use. Yeah, it is the Hilton. It is the Hilton. And you know what I found so amazing? I found the women there were so energetic and so dynamic. I heard, I met Lori Palatnik for the first time. Have you ever met her?
Oh, wow. Wow.
And she was amazing. You know, I looked at her, and she really inspired me because she was talking about the Jewish Renaissance movement that she started, which is something that I'm not really going to be doing because I have my own in-reach work that I'm doing here in my own community. But there's something that she said about Jewish women, which really I was blown away. She said, if you can change a woman, you change her family. And if you change enough families, you can change your community. And if you change enough community, you can change the world. And I love that. I love that because it's so true. It's so true that we as women have just something innate about us, something about being a woman. And it was just so redeeming, and it was so energetic and so excited. I said, Lori, I'm not going on your trip to Israel, but I'm going to take your slogan. if I have your permission, I am going to use it for my mission. Because my mission is...
I heard her in the summer, and I quote her all, like the same thing. I quote her all the time. I say it in different ways. She talks about like using, like being the car of women and how like... She says, when you are Makari of women, she says it the other way. She says, when you're Makari of men, when you're Makari of men, you will create problems. And when you are Makari of women, you create generations. You know?
It's true.
So
when I was in law school, one of my classmates was dying to learn about Yiddishkeit. And, you know, she had married an Israeli because that was her way she's going to connect with Judaism, but he wasn't religious. And while we were in law school together, she had taken on more and more mitzvot. By the time we graduated, she was Shomer Shabbos, and she brought her husband with her.
She says anytime a man, she says when a man like decides that he wants to get interested in stuff, so all he's doing is creating one imposition on the woman after another. You know, you have to do this and you can't do that, and you know. And she says when a woman is the one that's getting interested first, so she's the one. That, you know, she'll call her husband and say, honey, come home a little bit early on this Friday. Like, I made some of your favorite foods. And he'll come into a clean house and, you know, beautifully dressed children and delicious, you know, his favorite foods. And like she said, he doesn't need to know all the details because she doesn't have to impose them on him because he can just, like, you know, appreciate the beauty of it first. And mm-hmm. and then, like, you know, how much does it really require of him if she's the one sort of pulling him along and into the beauty first? You know, so and when it's the opposite, when you know, honey, you have to make this and you have to start it by that time, and you can't do this, like it just doesn't work.
Yeah. You know, and it was for me, it was you know, I come from a world where Hasidim, and for it's really in many ways it seems like it's a man's world. And the reason why it seems that way is because women are so busy with their families and everything else, they never really want to do anything more than stay home. So, and when you want to go out, you think like, oh, is this right? Is it appropriate? And sure it is. Of course it is. You just have to just make sure you're doing, you're following the rules, following halacha, and it could work. And when you actually hear it from, you know, it's like, it just like validates everything that I stand for. Yes, we can do so much as women, and our opportunity to inspire people is just that much greater. It's just that much greater than the men. And I see, because I think Lori was a fantastic speaker. I think she was better than most of the men that I heard speak.
It's not even
so much what she was saying. It was just, you knew that she was living. Yeah, she was breathing and living what she was saying with excitement. It wasn't just like somebody, let's say if you have, let's say, an architect talking about designing buildings who just talks about the different dimensions. Oh yeah, but I can talk about building, and you could just feel the energy that he just loves what he's doing. And mm-hmm. Lori just loves what she's doing, and then her message about women and our power that we have, and you know, the being a yeseira that we have, it was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That was wonderful. All right,
I guess the lady is not coming. She'll probably send an email. I'm gonna hang up. She's probably gonna send an email saying that she whatever happens.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, I already sent her an email myself. Okay, ladies, I'm gonna go now. Good night.
Take care.
Have a good night.
Nice to see you. Bye bye.
Likewise. All the best. Good night. Bye.